Welcome to the Coach Steve Clark Show, where he will encourage, inspire, and equip coaches, players, and parents who will in turn motivate and help others to promote the great game of tennis, foster sportsmanship, and develop greater players and people. Thanks for joining us, and here's your host, Steve Clark.
Hi, this is Steve Clark. Hey, thanks for joining me today. This show is recorded, so if you try and call in, I don't pick up. It's because I'm not here. I'm either on the tennis court with my team or we're at a tournament traveling, so I need to take some opportunities just to have our time to go over a few things. Today, I want to go over some big picture items. And particularly, I wanted to go over a philosophy of sorts of mine, or you might say an acronym that I use to encompass a lot of the things that I do on court. And this is with a team or individuals. I call it my focus outline or focus philosophy. I'll go over that, as well as talking about process versus outcome or product-oriented coaching. Additionally, I want to talk about some aspects of competition, maybe a proper view of competition. And related to that is transformational coaching versus transactional coaching. A former professional football player, Joe Ehrman, wrote a book called Inside Out Coaching, and he talks about this. And I think if you ever want to have an excellent read, pick a copy of that up. But he talks about, and I think he words it really well, what a lot of us coaches think about, and that's transformational versus transactional coaching, and I'll go through that a little bit. And, you know, one of the questions, for example, in that is, do sports really teach character? And if so, what about it? Or if not, what is needed? So one of the first things I'd like to do is just go over my focus philosophy. And the first thing in dealing or spelling it out is it's obviously F-O-C-U-S. The F stands for fundamentals. The O stands for opportunities. C stands for conditioning, U for unity, and S for success. And I'd mentioned this on a prior broadcast after I'd finished an interview. And years ago, when I was at the All-American Tournament in Texas, in Austin, Texas, I had a couple of my players, they were captains of the team, and we discussed how would we like to formalize what we really believe in when we practice day in and day out, and the time we put on court, and our scheduling, and all these things. And it's actually become a formal mantra I use. Things are kind of based on it. I also have posters and other things that I use for it. But again, it's fundamentals, opportunity, conditioning, unity, and success. There's some other values associated with that, and I'll go over those in a bit. But let me first start off with fundamentals. So fundamentals, you know, we want to strive to have all court-oriented players. They're fundamentally solid mechanically, and the all-court player can put pressure on opponents from just about anywhere on the court. Oftentimes, players are too one-dimensional, or they may have a blatant weakness. And obviously, one of the fastest ways to improve your game is to work on a weakness. So if you're focused on the fundamentals, knowing, in fact, Manny Diaz over Georgia, we talked about this just about practice, what we're doing in practice. And he mentioned the whole idea of and I agree with him, is that in your practice, you should have several components where your strengths and you feel really comfortable and you work on those things, because those are, after all, ways you win your points the majority of the time. You know, your patterns of play, I call it bread and butter. You should have those down and spend time practicing them. But that there's also the times that you need to have your weaknesses worked on. So let's say in a practice, maybe we're just talking about a format, is you have maybe three or four things that you work on your strengths, a couple things in between, and then maybe a couple weaknesses. Because if you can shore those up, then it's harder for people to attack you. But on a real broad scale, though, fundamentals aren't just tactical. They're also technical, mental, time management, momentum management. And I would even say warming up, or kind of how even stretching, all these things that go into preparation for a match or in practice, those are part of your fundamentals. So, for example, I do think that, you know, I have another piece that I write and I'll probably talk about sometime, is the whole idea that most people, when they talk about their, you know, what would they like to improve on, they're always talking about their strokes. Well, really, the majority of the time that we play, a good portion of that is not doing anything. So you have, I think the average on tour, it may be increasing now, but it used to be years ago, a point was maybe 10 seconds long for the men. And then, you know, you have 20 seconds between points. So most people, they had a lot of time. You might call it solitary time between the points. And I like the way the Australians word it, but you go have a walkabout. But the idea is, what do we do between that time? Well, I addressed this last time. I'll probably go into a little more in depth here. But it's, I call it PRPR. You should have a positive physical response, preparation, or relaxation, preparation, and ritual. And so the idea is, how much do people actually spend time on that? Well, I'll spend a boatload of time. So to me, I'll actually have practices dedicated towards that, training people how to have proper PRPR between points. Because the mental, emotional aspect of tennis is significant. Most people you talk to will say, well, you know, it's 80% of the game or whatever percentage it is. Well, if it's that much, why don't people work on it? You know, because they know that, you know, hitting a shot is tangible. You can see the results. Well, I think you'd be safe to say that Djokovic, for example, all of a sudden didn't have just a different forehand, and that was the difference between what he used to do and what he does now. It's, you know, he had a complete mind shift on how he was going to compete and how hard he was going to work, and just the stick-to-itiness that he has. I don't know if that's a word, but stick-to-itiness. So the mental aspect is huge. So that would be part of the fundamentals. And as well as just your shot selection, working on you know, bread and butter shots. Even in martial arts, I, you know, train in for many years, you have certain combinations that you feel really comfortable with, and that, you know, if somebody moves one way, you can counter and do a couple different things. Well, it's the same thing in tennis. You have, for example, if I'm going to be on the ad side and I feel like it's a break point against me, then I know, for example, my kicker out wide, and if I'm going to serve and volley, great, but if I stay back, I know I'm probably going to get a ball up the middle of the court. And then I'm going to take that forehand and, you know, go to the deuce side, either end attack, follow it in, or, you know, take a pretty good crack at it. So you're going to have bread and butters. Or if you're playing a, you know, a two-hander's got a really nice high return, that kicker might be neutralized. So you got to have plan B. And so you have these bread and butter shots, but you got to practice them. So it's just not the technical work. It's more of the mental preparation and that sort of thing. So again, fundamentals are several aspects, not just technical. Now, I will say this, and I agree 100% with Stevie Johnson and some other people that I've had on the show, that at a younger age, the more you have those fundamentals down, then it just becomes a matter of time before you grow into your shots, etc. So it's really working on the ability to have an all-court game. So I work on, even with younger players that have the aptitude, I want them to know how to serve and volley. I want them to know how to hit a chip return, maybe even follow it in. I want them to be able to hit a half volley, to be able to hit slices off both sides. I call also what's called a get-out-of-jail-free card. I want them to be able to take, turn their grip a little bit and do a little squash shot on the forehand and use a continental grip, or maybe even a more severe grip on the backhand side to hit balls from behind them, you know, if they have to get out of jail. So it's just learning how to do a little bit of everything, so that regardless of where they are on the court, they can sustain a point and go from defense and then all of a sudden be able to move quickly up and go to offense. That's fundamentals. And so, they're having, obviously good technique in their game, technically, mechanically, but then also just understanding that they do want to attack. And this is what I call, having a presence on the court. You want to position people to death, or you want to let them feel the weight of your presence. So even at a younger age, I want, even though kids are short, for example, like even my son or other players that have kind of full court, all court games, I want them to learn how to position people to death and kind of get in there and take balls from midcourt, or, feel comfortable coming in when an opponent's stretched out. So that's fundamental in terms of the technical, the mechanical, but also their shot selection, what's their bread and butter, what can they count on, and then especially their mental control, their PRPR, their attitude. And while we're at that, I'll just go over that again: positive physical response, relaxation, preparation, and ritual. Again, being a fundamental that we need to work on is our mental aspect of the game. So, for example, if you were to finish a point up at net, you would immediately put the racket in the opposite hand, and you turn from the point, you put your back to the point. That's basically a physical way of saying I'm putting the point behind me, and then your head shouldn't be drooping or anything. You can fist pump, you can slap yourself in the thigh, you can do all sorts of these things, but the main look is a positive physical response. A lot of times you'll see people, they'll just kind of hold onto the racket handle, and it'll just, the racket will droop. Well, that's not as in control looking or aggressive looking than if you hold the racket by the throat and the tip of the racket's up and the butt is down. If you look at most great players, the racket's in the opposite side of the opposite hand. So if they're right-handed, after the point, they put it in the left hand and they have it with that look where the tip is facing up a little bit, it's angled upward, and the butt's facing down. And it just has a certain look about when they walk back. There's a certain stride. So you have that positive physical response. And then a couple seconds after that is you're spending time relaxing. You're dropping the heart rate, whether you won or lost the point, not giving away too much of what's going on. So that's the second part, is positive physical response, then relaxation. And as you cross the baseline, before you step and serve, that's one of the biggest mistakes people make, is they go up to the baseline, turn around and serve, and oftentimes call the serve even before or while they're tossing, which actually is against the rules because you can't talk during a point. And technically, when you started your take back motion, you've started the point. That's one of my biggest pet peeves, is people doing that. And I work with them on that, is actually developing a ritual. But as you cross the line, you have to have preparation. You have to think of the next point and what you're going to do, your plan A, plan B, and at least so you know when you step up to serve or return, whichever you're doing, that you're, I call it brain dead or autopilot, that there isn't a whole lot of thought going on, that you know what you're going to do, you're sticking to your game plan and your style of play and that sort of thing, and then you let it rip. So that's your preparation. So now your ritual before you serve or return should be the same every time, and if you don't have one, then you should develop one. I'll stand next to the service line, bounce the ball three times, and I have a pause, and then I'll start my swing. If you look at all great athletes, people with good control in sports, There's always a pause before they execute. Hoops is the same thing. They'll bounce the ball a few times, put it in their hands, look at the hoop, pause, and then shoot. Same thing with divers. You know, get to the end, they kind of pause, and then they jump off a 30-meter board into a bucket. So they're amazing athletes the way they do that. So, but there's always a pause. So it's the same thing in your ritual. When you're returning, there should be a sense, a time of relaxation and steadiness. So that's PR in a nutshell. And it generally you can practice it. And I work with teams on this, singles, doubles. We work through how we connect in doubles together. I call it circular. So it's, you always come together, walk back with your partner, and then circle back. There always needs to be kind of a hop step, an energetic hop step going back to net. So there's this constant communication throughout, whether you use signals or not. That's part of your preparation. As a doubles player, that's part of your PR. And this is one thing I mentioned on a prior broadcast, is that singles players, if they're they should make good doubles players to themselves. I mean, if you were playing doubles with somebody and you like playing doubles with them and had good chemistry, you wouldn't, after they missed a shot, you wouldn't say, "Hey, you knucklehead, what are you doing that for?" You would say, "Hey, that's all right." And your opponent might say, "Hey, my bad." And you go, "That's okay, let's get this next one." Well, that's how you should do it in singles. So you should treat yourself like a good doubles partner would. And PR helps you do that, being mindful of that. So that's a fundamental, is learning how to manage the points between points. And another major fundamental, and I think Chuck Creasy's right on this, is if you can control the momentum of a tennis match, you can control the match. Well, that may seem like kind of obvious, but most people that I watch when I watch them play points, nobody has control of the momentum. It's kind of a tit for tat or back and forth, add in, deuce, add out, or 15 love, 15 all, 15 30, 30 all. As opposed to, and it's because of the shot selection. It's not because the other person is, that good or you made that many mistakes or whatever. It's just because of the shot selection. They're not really aware that if you can win 3 points in a row, obviously you want to win every point. But people don't think that way. If you can win 3 points in a row, you can control the momentum of a match. And let me give you an example how it often goes. Somebody will break, and then the next point, inevitably, I'll ask people this, and I say, "What happens if somebody just your opponent just broke you? What do they do that next point?" Oftentimes, there's a sense of relief, and it's like, "Whew, they can let their guard down." What do? They play looser, and if they play looser, then they're going to be in trouble. So that's what you want to avoid. But if you're thinking more along the lines of what I call triplets or, 3 points in a row, then if you just won deuce, add out, and you won the game, you're thinking the next point, whether you're serving or returning, I got to win this point because that will clinch my momentum swing. And it's really intuitive. I mean, if you think about it, anybody watching a tennis match, just think about this. You're sitting there watching, and it's 30 love, and all of a sudden it's 30-15. You don't think too much of it watching. Then it's 30 all. You're going, "Oh." Let's say it's 5 all in the set, and you're going, "Ooh, okay." And you go, "That's all right." And then it's 30-40. They've lost 3 points in a row. Everybody's going, "Whoops, something's, somebody's losing the momentum." And then they win that game or whatever. They know, it's fairly intuitive. And even the score, I mean, I don't know about any of you out there, but I recall, have you lost, anybody that's won a match when they were down 6-0, 5-0? So it's possible because it's not the score per se that matters. It's how you control the momentum. And can you recognize it and stop the bleeding? And that's a skill set, learning how to use your shot selection, your shot selection to control the momentum, switch the momentum, maintain the momentum, or gain it. So these are some of the things that are fundamentals that we work on that a lot of times people just skip because they're more technical or mechanically based. And personally, I think one of the biggest things that lacks in even working with juniors, I think adults most of the time have a fairly good grasp of these things, even though I've worked with a lot of adults where I have to kind of help them on it. But a lot of times, and this is when we go into transformational coaching as and versus transactional coaching, is I think a lot of coaches, and I can't be broad brushing it, but a lot of programs, the coaches, they're really more into the numbers, and they really don't emphasize this mental or emotional aspect of tennis because it's just, it's not worth the time. They want to get more people on court and make more money. And that's transactional coaching. It's just your child or somebody's just a transaction. And so there really should be, any program they're in, there should be an emphasis on character. There should be an emphasis on mental development, emotional development, being mentally strong between points. In the long run, that's what's going to do it. So that would be a case of a fundamental that has to be approached. Secondly is opportunity, and I might bounce back if I can remember a couple things or just if we come across a couple things for fundamentals, but there's a lot of overlap. But opportunity. Opportunity, we talk a lot of times about scheduling. You know, we got to have an opportunity. You can have the greatest forehand in the world, but if you don't get a chance to use it, you're not going to go very far. So opportunities in terms of scheduling is really important. So you got to have a tough enough schedule. And obviously, you don't want your schedule so tough, you know, whether it's a team event or an individual event, that you're losing a lot, although we do learn from losses. I think Wayne Bryan said that the Bryan brothers, obviously, when they were going up through the juniors, they played probably more tournaments than most people I know, but they lost a lot. But from that, you learn, well, in order to beat that guy, I need to work on this, so it just makes you better. Well, that's an opportunity, the schedule. So in collegiate coaching, the scheduling, I think, is highly significant. I always try and play as, you know, we try and play as many ranked teams as possible. And then you have certain, you know, some teams you might say, look, we want to play 25% or in this ranked range, another 25% in this, and another 25 or 50 in this range. You want to make sure you have matches that you know you can win and some that are going to be really pushing and some that, hey, you're lucky if you get out of there alive. Because all those you're going to get skill sets from. So those are type of opportunities. But fundamentally, the opportunity that's most important is what you're doing every single day in practice. The opportunity, I remember one time when I was coaching a group of guys, I'd stop them and say, hey, just look around, look at the stars. Or not the stars, it was during the day. I said, look at the sun, look at the mountains. This is gorgeous out here. You know, it's just an opportunity to be playing. I mean, it's that first and foremost. What a privilege to be able to play this game, particularly as part of a team, have a bunch of great buddies, that sort of thing. But opportunities is day-to-day practice. So it's an opportunity. Man, I tell you what, if I had – sometimes I'll tell guys if they get a little frustrated with something. I said, man, if I had somebody feeding me serves just so I could work on my return, that's like eating ice cream. You know, just you know, one of the most important shots in the game. Somebody's going to spend time hitting serves to you. That's like a bonus. So looking for those opportunities. Along those lines, there's a saying, what are you doing with the dash? And I have this written on our team practice shirts. There's just a dash, and there's just a dash on some of our competition shirts. And people go, well, what's that line? I said, well, it's a dash. And what it means is, what are you doing with the time? You know, ultimately, we're born at a certain date and we die. So what are we doing with that little dash between them? Well, we can kind of cut that up into all sorts of time frames. So, for example, what am I doing with the dash right now, doing this recording? It's fairly late at night. I could be sleeping, but I wanted to get this out. And there's been a lot of people with a lot of positive feedback who want to hear things and write in and send questions, that sort of thing. They like a lot of the interviews. So I'm using this opportunity to help, you know, promote tennis. But again, the goal of the show is to encourage and inspire and educate coaches, parents, and young players so they can in turn turn around and inspire and instruct and motivate other players and parents and coaches so we have better tennis players and hopefully you know, we all are better people for it. So that's part of the goal. So that's what I'm using this dash for. But what we're talking about is even on practice. So when we show up to practice, what are we using that time for? When we're working on our returns, are we focused on that time? When we're working on our serve and volley and our, I have a, what's called a three-shot series. Can we make those three shots? I have a warm-up drill where the entire team has to hit for 5 minutes and they can't miss or restart it. You know, are we focused on that thing in terms of hitting our groundies and our movement up and back to the net and back to the baseline and that sort of thing? Are we focused on our studies? What are we doing with the dash in our studies? You know, are we doing giving our best? Are we just, you know, getting by? Are we our time management skills, socially, you know, the types of friends we're hanging out with and the things we're doing, any hobbies and things like that. So there's tons of opportunities to say, okay, what am I doing with my time? What am I doing with the dash? So those are all important. So those are opportunities. Again, one of the most important opportunities is every day is not only to work on your strengths, but to work on your weaknesses. A lot of players want to shy away from that. But really, champions, you know, if you remember, I had a short show with Alan Fox. He'll be joining me in the future to kind of, excuse me, be more, address his book more in length. But he said his goal was just to outwork everybody. You know, he said he wasn't the greatest athlete, but he just wanted to work harder than everybody. And you put in the time. You put in a lot of time working on shots, that weakness. I'll give you an example. I had a former player for me. He was in San Diego. He played at the time 12 on the team. He was like 125 in the country. He was number 12 on my team. By his senior year, he was number one on the team, top 25 in the country. And when he went on tour, he was about 500 in the world before he got a bit of a shoulder injury. But one of the things, he had a two-hand forehand. And Chris, I'm talking about you if you're listening. So he had a two-hand forehand. And the thing is, yeah, two-hand forehand, one-hand backhand. And that's just kind of how he had started when he was younger. But at that level, some guys could kind of take advantage of that two-hander. So I had to teach him a one-hander to release that hand. And we'd go out early in the morning. And this is in addition to normal team practice. And he'd want to work on that forehand. So we worked on it, worked on it, worked on it. I remember, you know, the feeling he got when he ripped a one-hander, he was stretched out wide. The guy thought he had him, and he ripped a one-hander. And the hooting and hollering on the court after that feeling of elation was well worth it. So working on those weaknesses. And now I think he hits with a one-hander all the time. So so the opportunities are abundant every day, and just it's how you look at it. Thirdly is the C, conditioning. So it goes without saying that, in fact, I think there's been a recent article. I'm still looking. I'd heard about it, but I'd like to find out. But it talked about tennis players being the most conditioned and, if not, the most complete athletes of all sports. Nowadays, I could understand that speed, agility, strength, finesse, just all those different things. But and the body percentage, body weight, and fitness, and all that. The conditioning is, I've always felt as a player, and even as a coach, you know, I try and keep fit enough to model it. But when we shake hands with an opponent, we should be saying to them, "All right, buddy," or if you're a gal, "All right, lady. If this thing goes three sets, you're mine, because I am way more fit than you. And there is nothing you can do that's going to tire me out." If you look at Federer, you ever see the guy tired, ever? I mean, Djokovic runs around, and I think he's just more emotive than Federer, but just doesn't look tired. And some of the other guys on the tour, comparably, look gassed sometimes. But I don't think I've ever seen Federer gassed, and other players. So even at the collegiate level or even at the elite junior level, if you're going to be, I even tell just, you know, your average junior that, look, if you're more fit than the other player, if you're faster, if you're quicker, it'll make whatever game you bring to the table way better. So if you keep everything constant and you just get better fit, you know, and better fitness, you have a huge advantage. That's a weapon. I think a lot of people don't realize that your fitness is a weapon. And if you're quick to the ball, then, you know, even if you're a little off on a technique or a technical aspect of your game, you can make up for a lot by being fit. But bottom line is, you know, there's this old saying about fatigue makes cowards of us all. I mean, it is true in tennis. You get tired and you don't want to engage in that long rally. You go for the cheap shot. You go for the drop shot. You go for too much because you just know you can't sustain it. The better shape you're in, the more of a nightmare it's going to be for your opponent. So your conditioning needs is very important. One of those aspects of conditioning that I find is that a lot of people, and I work, I intentionally do this, is a lot of people aren't even aware of their nutrition. And so I have an actual nutrition handout that I go over with my players and a nutrition quiz that they have to take. And it's just mainly for just so they actually know how when they go to the grocery store and they got to get food or there are certain places, they know how to pick food, be able to calculate just quickly, you know, the grams of protein and, you know, and how many calories that actually is or what percentage really is all that matters in terms of the fat intake and that sort of thing. So they know when they're picking up something, is it 30% fat? Is it 10% fat? Is it 50? And just to be able to at least be wise about their choices, protein, carbohydrate, etc. So that's an important part. But you can't expect a lot of people to know it if they're not educated. So a lot of times I just use a type of a short quiz and a handout, and I go over it with them so they at least are aware of that, particularly at an elite level. Athletes burn off and require serious amounts of carbohydrates, and you know, you need your proteins after you play. And it's good to know just the type of, and I can go over this sometime, but just the type of water consumption, and people excuse me, aren't just aware of all that goes into preparing and sustaining your body. And then fourthly is unity. Team unity is huge, but even if you're not part of a team, you know, tennis is it's a team effort, you know, whether it's your parents and your coaches and friends. And but I'll just speak from a collegiate point of view, is you've got to have that team unity. There's a study recently that talks about social cohesion as opposed to team goal unity. So, for example, a lot of times teams will say, hey, we're all goal-minded. We all have the right same goal, so we can kind of work hard, and we're real tight on that goal. You know, football team might be that way, or basketball, hey, we're going to win conference, we're aiming for a national championship, or whatever it is. And that goal keeps people focused. But what you'll have a lot of times in those locker rooms, you have a lot of dissension socially, yeah, but they're focused professionally. Let's say if we look at the professional ranks, you'll hear about this all the time. Hey, I don't care what they do in their private life, and we don't get along, et cetera, but when we get on the field, it's all business. Well, it's been actually, there's been a recent study that talks about what's called social cohesion, or in other words, unity and actually liking being with each other has far greater results than product or result cohesion. So, for example, if you have players that enjoy being with each other and do things socially, that ingredient or you might say extra ingredient, because of their liking each other, caring about each other, propels that team or that pair or whatever to a much higher level than if they weren't. So it's an interesting study, but all that to say is that unity is a huge factor in success. And then the last thing, I'll mention this, is even while I was coaching the Big West many years ago, there was, you know, we won it a few times and pretty much we're always in the finals, but I think worst was semifinals. But one time we had lost to a team that, if you looked on paper, we were much stronger than. We had several guys that were in the top five in the country, et cetera. But we lost to a team, and it's because of this social cohesion. They had nothing to lose, they just kind of enjoyed hanging out and doing stuff. And so they, I think, you know, there was just that little something, you might say, special or extra that for that given team that just helped them propel, just dig down deeper. So it worked in their favor. So it is tangible in that sense. So we've had fundamentals, opportunity, conditioning, unity, and the last thing is success. You're going to have success if you have all those things. It's unavoidable. You will have success. Now, how you label success or how you measure it, that's up to your definition of success, but you will have success. I mean, think about it. If you work on your fundamentals hard, if you have the opportunity to practice and implement those fundamentals and you're in shape and you have team unity, you already have success. You've already been doing those things. So it's kind of icing on the cake for those other things for success. Now, let me back up, because part of that is I have some sayings I use, and they kind of encompass all this. If you always give your best, you'll sometimes play your best and one time be the best. Well, in this focus idea, if you always give your best, let's just start there. Most people, I mean, I don't want to throw everybody under the bus. A lot of people, many people, do not give their best. A lot of youth that I work with or that I'll do clinics for, their best is, because I see it all the time, they'll work hard, but, and they think that's their best, and then when you actually get them to do way more, then the whole ruler has changed. The whole measuring stick has changed. Now they're like, oh, that's my best. What I thought was my best isn't even close. And I give them a little test a lot, just about every time I start with a new group. I call it the jump test. I've been doing this for about 20 years, and it never fails. Is I have people stand on the sideline, and I ask them for, everybody's toes on there, and I want you to jump as far as you can. So they all do, and I have them stop, and they mark if there's depending on the number of people, I'll have a little piece of chalk or something. We'll mark where they landed. I'll have them go back, and I'll say, okay, now imagine your parents giving you a milkshake if you beat it, or if I have something. Sometimes I'll just have a couple students get up and do it, and I'll give them a reward if they beat it, and the class cheers for them or the group of people cheer for them. But inevitably, everybody, I've only had a few exceptions where they don't for whatever reason. They got a late start or whatever. I say, I want you to beat it. If you beat it, you'll get this prize. And they do. They beat it. So then I'll ask them, well, what? So my first question is, what did I ask you to do? And they'll say, oh, jump far or something. And then usually it takes a couple guesses. And then usually some kid will say, oh, you asked us to jump as far as we can. And my next question is, and I'll let you think about that, what do you think my next question is? My next question is, well, why didn't you? And usually I get these looks at me like, that's not fair. Well, the point is, I ask them, I say, well, why didn't you? And they say, well, because we weren't motivated. There was no, I say, oh, really? You need internal motivation? External motivation in life, as opposed to you don't want to do it just because you want to be better at something? So that reveals something. I mean, we all like external motivation. But I think John Wooden was the classic that most coaches follow, that he didn't believe in external motivation. He said, you either want it or you don't. But I think external motivation, I think Wayne Bryant talks about this, is backdoor motivation and being sneaky about it. And I agree. It's fun. You know, you get a cookie if a kid does something. We all like it. And let's not kid ourselves. Everybody likes a pay raise. There's external motivation. But external motivation. So I'll ask them, what else? And they'll say, well, because we don't know. And I've had kids, and the light will go on. They'll go, because we don't know how far we can do it. And I said, exactly. I said, that's the job of a coach or a parent or a teacher. Is our job, and I used to have a saying, I still use it, is my job as a coach or as a mentor, as a teacher, is to get you to do things you don't necessarily want to do. For example, study, read, or run the lines, or work hard on the court, or whatever it is, to get you to a place you never thought you could be. And in other words, you know, you have somebody who has raw talent, you put them through the rigors and the discipline while having fun, and then to the point where they wouldn't do it themselves because people don't push themselves enough because they don't know what they're capable of, and that's the whole point. They would have jumped as far as they could in the first place if they were capable of it. And so then you motivate, push, disciple, mentor, encourage, etc., whatever you want to call it, and you get them to be better at it. Now their normal is much higher, and their expectations are much higher. So they get that idea. And I said, well, so every time you're on the court with me now and with these other coaches, or if you're in school, your best, you have to realize that jumping as far as you can, you're not really aware of what that can is, your ability. And this goes along to another saying that I have is that, and I put this up on some posters, is that rare greatness comes at a steep price. Mediocrity is abundant and cheap. Rare greatness comes at a steep price. Mediocrity is abundant and cheap. And that's especially because most people, or many people, I'll go back, I don't want to throw everybody under the bus, is we tend to think that what we're capable of is this great thing. And that's why the kids don't jump as far as they can. They say, "Oh, I can. That's as far as I can jump." No, it's not. You can jump way farther than that. And if I bet if I asked them, I'd put $1,000 on the line. I bet they could beat that other mark. So our mediocrity is where we tend to live, but rare greatness is abundant and cheap. I mean, greatness is comes at a steep price, rather. And it takes hard work, and it takes vision, and it takes someone to push you. So the whole idea of our focus is to get us there, and our coaches are to help us get us there. So I mentioned about the kind of the focus philosophy, or how I operate each day, or, you know, the different things. You know, obviously there's other philosophies of coaching, but that's more of an acronym of that kind of guide, some guiding principles. But let me go into what's called different aspects of competition, or particularly what's called transformational coaching. And I'd like to actually kind of go over some things that Joe Erman wrote in his book, Inside Out Coaching. And he talks about transformational versus transactional coaching. And one of those things is, well, first of all, what is transactional versus transformational coaching? Well, in kind of describing some of it, the question will be answered. But transformational coaching is coaching that is more concerned about the, you know, about the whole person / the process rather than the product. So we often talk about process versus product goals or focus. And I think most coaches will tell you they're, or a good coach, I'd say, is more interested in the process. Why? Because if the process is done right, the results speak for themselves. So, for example, that's why, you know, I have even athletes that maybe don't want to, in doubles, or still not used to serving volleying. Well, if you do it enough, it pays off, and you're more proficient at it. There's a reason why Mike and Bob Bryan are the best doubles team in the world. There's many reasons, but they're very proficient at it. Jack Kramer used to say, even watching, you know, it's just pure geometry. You get up the net, it's easier to cover things. Now, obviously, the game's changed a lot these days with the power and the speed of things. But you still want to pressure people the closer you are to net. I have a little ball toss example I use with people that I'll toss the ball. You know, if they're far from me, they have no chance of getting it on a certain angle if they keep the angle the same. The closer they get to me, all they got to do is stick out their hand and they can get it. So it's the same principle with volleys. Again, the point here is the process. So if you focus on the process and doing things right, the results take care of themselves. If you focus on the product, then the ends justify the means. Then we have tarring of baseball bats. We have Deflategate in the NFL. We have anabolic steroids. We have cheating. We have all this stuff because all you're focused on is the product instead of the process. Transactional coaching is, and he gives a whole list of what transactional coaches do. But for example, some of them operate out of shame, or there's just something in their past. Maybe they have to prove something, or, you know, it doesn't have to be that insidious, but it's the idea that they're not really concerned about the person. They're more concerned about the win-loss, or maybe how they look to other people. I mean, let's face it, some coaches, if they lose, their reputation's on the line, so they're going to jump on a kid for making a bad play. That's transactional coaching, which isn't to say that a coach can't get upset, but we're going to talk about some of those issues. So, for example, he talks about inside-out coaching, and I agree 100% on this, is as a coach or a teacher, I think that's why as coaches and teachers, it's more of a calling, you might say. When you're involved with youth or if you're a director, you know, of some sort, it's you do it because you really care about the development of the sport. I'd put this out here. I think boy, this is another whole topic. But if you just really honor the sport, and I'll talk about this in competition, but if you really honor the sport itself, you know, respect it, the history and things like that, you're going to act a lot differently than if you're more interested in the wins and losses. You know, successful transformational coaches who care about the players, they have inside out. They're actually why they ask the internal questions and why do they do certain things. And so here's some questions. Why does someone coach? And as a parent, you might want to ask this. If you're putting your kid into a program or things like this, you want to know if the coach is transformational or transactional. A, they can say one thing, but what do they do? Why do I coach? You know, we can ask ourselves that. Why do I coach the way I do? Like, I know I coach the way I do. A, I'm extremely competitive. I'm detail-oriented. I learned a lot by watching. I was, you know, blessed with an athleticism where I can watch something and then kind of mimic it, whether it's windsurfing or whatever it is. So I do a lot of visual, but I know a lot of people aren't visual. So I do part whole or whole part. It just depends on the person. So I'm a teacher kind of mentality where I'm really patient, where I was like, I'll dissect something for hours if somebody needs it. But some people don't need dissection. Some people just need to look at something and just do it. But why do I coach that way? Well, sometimes, and that's why some coaches connect better with other people, is it works for them. And then you go, oh, okay, you connect with somebody and go, this is, try this. Well, you coach that way because that's how you learned how to play. Maybe you coach a certain way because of somebody that inspired you. Why do I coach in the first place? And again, I'm asking questions from your end if you're asking yourself these, but I'll give you a quick example. My coach in college, Bob Biggs over at UC Davis, he was, you might call, player's coach. He wasn't necessarily, you know, one of the best tennis players in the world, but he knew how to coach, and he knew how to relate to athletes, and he was an athlete himself, played professional football, etc. So he was highly respected, and just, you know, so for me, it was an enjoyable experience. And he was competitive like I am, extremely, so I could relate to that. But he did it with class, and he fought hard, and those sort of things. So when you have great people that are in your life that coach, those characteristics bleed over. So I'm sure that's a huge reason I coach. Been coaching for so long, you know, and after playing world team tennis, I was, you know, you have a direction of whether you're going to, you know, play on tour or whatnot. And, you know, to me, the coaching was in the blood and, you know, and our directing and being involved in teaching to some degree. So, and that's one of the reasons I have my master's degrees and doctorate, et cetera, because I enjoy that aspect, kind of that mentoring or that teaching aspect. So why do I coach the way I do is a question you could ask yourself, or, you know, wonder about a coach working with your child. What does it feel like to be coached by me is another question. I think that's a great question. What does it feel like to be coached by me? So that's a question that you could ask of somebody, you know, or you could think about yourself. Would you like to be coached by me? Or I ask that like myself. Would I, Steve, would you like to be coached by me? In many ways, yes. Sometimes, I don't know. I have to think about that. I know there's sometimes when if I do lose, you know, if there's a certain aspect of, let's say, a day is going a little sour, would I want that? You know, you have to think about it. What do I want to accomplish by coaching? How do I, or in other words, how do I define success? So you could ask yourself that, or maybe even ask a coach, what do you define as successful? And we'll cover that in just a moment. But so those are, a transformational coach might, should have answers to those. Transactional coach, they might, but at the same time, maybe they're more interested. And Joe Erman gives a lot of examples, you know, coming from professional football, where there's, you know, a lot of transactional coaches, right, in his experience. And he was obviously a great, phenomenal football player. And he gives some funny stories that I'm going to read in a sec. So bottom line is setting up some of the more inside-out, kind of dealing with some of the inside-out issues of coaching, and he labels those transformational coaching as opposed to transactional. So again, one of the important things about those questions is maybe as a parent you could be asking your kid, your kids' coaches or instructors maybe some of those questions. Or maybe at least kind of paying attention to see maybe what they might respond to those, or what do they actually do. Because a lot of times proof is in the pudding how somebody does something. You know, so in other words, you know, maybe take those questions and say, okay, what does it look like? Would I want to be coached by that person? Or how do they define success? That sort of thing. So along those lines, I just made a point out one other thing. Even and for those who are involved in education, I think Joe Erman makes a great point about sports being co-curricular. A lot of times in high schools, they'll call it co-curricular. And if they really believe that, then particularly even in most universities, they'll say, hey, we want people to be fully developed, you know, in mind, body, and spirit or whatnot. So to what degree do they support that, you know, in their athletics departments or the recreation, et cetera? But a lot of times in academia, people look at athletic activity or recreational activity as second tier. Well, really, I don't know many people that, for example, would disagree with this, that if you spend time training your body or getting activity and exercise, your mind is a lot clearer. And I think there's a huge kind of a disconnect when people say, well, you know, academics is more important, et cetera. Well, I think they go hand in hand. You know, we're not just we're complex beings, and our bodies and minds, I don't know about you, but pretty simple examples. If you're sick as a dog, it's really hard to concentrate. If you're tired, you know, our brains don't function too well. If we're physically not that healthy, I think there's a huge connection. And I think it's very important to see them both as equally important. So he talks about it being co-curricular. But so that's the reason I bring that up is some people may say, well, you know, they're just more focused on the sports as opposed to their academics or other things, but I think they're both highly related. So maybe a transformational coach might be more interested in education because of that. But let me go through some of his book highlights here. He says transformational coaches are dedicated to self-understanding and empathy, viewing sports as a virtuous discipline. Here's a really, I think, an insightful point, and this you can obviously with any of my comments here, you can email me at coachsteveclarkphd.com. He says here, a great myth of American sports is that they build character, because a lot of people will say, oh, sports build character. And I think he's onto something here, is that he says that, no, most sports are win at all costs. In particular, I think he's referring to the professional level. They're not building character. Now, we at the high school, junior, collegiate level, et cetera, we think that it does build character. But his point is this, winning or doing what it takes to win and all that is not what builds a character. The sports itself don't build character unless the coach possesses character and intentionally teaches it. So bottom line is, tennis, I think, is a phenomenal vehicle to learn self-discipline, time management, getting up after a loss. I mean, you're going to lose. I mean, the whole scoring system itself, just as Alan Fox talks about this, just brutal mentally. And then the ups and downs involved. So learning how to deal with pressure over and over and over. There's so many facets about the game. But just learning how, after the loss, to get up and play another tournament, even or another match in the back draw. But that's only because of the sport itself's not going to do that. It's the people around you who possess character and then intentionally teach it. So they use those moments to say, hey, you know, you lost, but this. So, for example, sometimes I'll say to my players, I say, look, okay, you lose this. If you lost this match, what's the worst possible thing? Your teammates still care for you. You still have a great support system, and you're going to get better. I mean, you know, so you know you got to work on that now. So that teaches character. As opposed to if I, you know, you know, the person say, man, I should have done X, Y, Z. You know, they're learning something about the sport, but they're not going to learn a lot of character. So we have to be intentional about it. But I think his point here is that the coach actually has to possess character and then be intentional about teaching it. So he also mentions along this line, he pulls a quote from Viktor Frankl, and he says, the greatest of all human freedoms is the ability to choose how to respond to any given circumstance. I don't know if that's a direct quote or if he's paraphrasing, but the point's well taken. Is you know, so a transformational coach is going to use those opportunities to teach their student athletes or their athletes how to respond to their situations. So I'd like to actually kind of take a break here to read a little bit of a story that Joe talks about in a book. And it goes along the lines, it's going to address this whole idea of competition. And I'll just kind of start off with the idea of competition. Competition, a lot of times I'm extremely competitive. And it was kind of my Achilles heel when I was younger. And then I went through a period of time in college where I remember turning to a friend of mine, and he was in the stands. I said, you know, this isn't cutting it, because I was getting ticked off. And I said, you know, I got to rethink this, bottom line. And so I took some time to think, how do I handle my emotions when I'm out on the court, because it was becoming counterproductive. And so I spent a summer doing it, and I was actually going to play football that year at college, and I was going to be a defensive back. And so I, as I was thinking about it, I thought, well, if I got angry, at least I can just deck somebody in a football, you know, a uniform. And so as I learned to kind of grapple with it, that's when I learned, hey, look, I can be a better player by learning how to channel and control these emotions because I'm so competitive. So a lot of times people think, well, I'm real competitive, that's who I am. No, there's no correlation between being competitive and being a knucklehead or being out of control or upset, etc. You know, you look at I'll just give perfect case in point. A guy like Federer, I respect him. Sampras, Edberg. I mean, these guys were extremely competitive. They wouldn't be the great players they were. Roy Emerson. But they knew how to keep their composure and be class acts and know the history of the sport and treat their opponents well. So a lot of times, you know, people, I call them weekend warriors, you know, they get all bent out of shape about things and they're, oh, I'm just competitive. Well, I don't think there's a correlation there. And one of the things that Joe Erdman talks about is, so all that to say, I'll finish my story, is so after I decided, hey, I have certain limitations on the things I need to do in order to control or to be able to utilize my competitiveness, you know, that's when I came back to school and I said, all right, let's do this thing. And that's when I ended up, you know, I was fortunate to be second in the country and an All-American, et cetera. I think it helped my game because I am so competitive. It doesn't matter what I'm doing, if it's ping pong or tiddlywinks or marbles, ultimate frisbee, extremely competitive, et cetera. So it helps you in all those things to be able to control those things. So, all that to say, competition comes from, he talks about this, coming from the Latin. You know, we don't need to get all technical about this, but it's basically, you know, competere, and it's mutual quest for striving for excellence. And so I'm going to read a little bit about this, because what people find out is if we're really competing well, we're actually – our opponent is somebody that helps me get better. Because you think about it, you can't get better. I mean, you tell people all the time, if you win everything, you're obviously not playing good enough people, so you're only going to get so good. So you have to have some losses in order to get better at something. And who's going to help you get that loss but an opponent? And, you know, obviously when you're out on the court or the field of competition, you're not thinking, oh, hey, thanks. Actually, Alan Fox did do that as a player. If he was losing, he'd say, hey, at least I can use this opportunity now to see if I can get into this guy's head and I can actually work on my mental game. So he used that as kind of a motivator instead of getting too ticked off. But Joe Erdman talks about, he gives a story where he talks about competing, and I'll read some of it. There's actually a pretty funny part to it. But he talks about his battle with Joe Hanna, who is a great offensive lineman in the NFL history. And he talks about how he competed against him. And one time, Joe Erdman had broken his hand, and he had to, several of his fingers or something, and he had to put his hand in a cast, and he thought, oh, this is great. Now I can just whack John upside the head. And so he said he hit him so hard he could hear the plaster hit the plastic of his helmet, and he let and John Hanna let out a little groan. So Joe Erdman's thinking, hey, I got him. And but he goes on to say he didn't do any better against him because John was such a good lineman. So he says, looking back, I don't think we ever talked during or after the game, but I always admired the way he handled himself on the field as a player and as a competitor. And now he gives this example of one time, what's called a pancake block, and he talks about pancake being laid out flat. And, you know, obviously no defensive lineman wants to be pancaked. So I'm going to read the little story. He says, John Hanna led the lead in pancake blocks. So not looking too good right here. He says, on a third and long, pushing down, I used my patented fake slap and swim move. I faked like I was going to go on the inside, slapped him on the outside, and should have been able to throw my arm over his body to swim past him and make the sack and be a hero of the game. I had meditated on all week, visualized it, and felt the sensation of my patented move. You know, we can visualize. And I think that's another actual thing you can practice going all the way back to fundamentals, focusing on his mental aspect, his vision, envisioning things. But here he says, the problem was he didn't go for the fake. My slap hardly moved him. And just as I was bringing my arm over his head to swim past him in that quote unquote swim move, he uncoiled with both fists and just launched them into my sternum. Immediately, I found myself suspended in midair, horizontal to the field. As I was floating back to the earth, the first thing I thought about, even before I hit the ground, was films on Monday. In other words, his teammates are going to be looking at the film. So, but one of the things that I haven't said yet is that Joe Irwin's brother had died recently. And so after Hannah came up to him to pull him off the field because he just decked him, he said, "Hey, man, I'm sorry to hear about the loss of your brother." And Joe Irwin, who was known for having a very kind of violent upbringing and just was, when you talk about the competitive, the transactional person, he didn't give a rip about anybody, and this is what he says in the book, until he started realizing these things. He says, "After the game, I realized that he had been sincere. Johanna was one of the greatest competitors I've ever played against, and this moment explains why. I felt we weren't so much attacking each other as trying to achieve something together. He was challenging me to raise my game to the new level. And I think this is why in pros, when we see great matches and they're hugging each other afterwards, you know, they just played, they had to bring out the best. And I think the greatest players say that. They say, you know what, he always brings, or she always brings out the best in me. I think that's what competition is supposed to be. And as competitive as I am, there's an old saying, would you rather play ugly and win or play well and lose? I would rather win, and then I'll go fix the ugly afterwards. I call it, let's fix the ugly. Don't end on an ugly. Go fix it afterwards. Some of the greatest players you'll find, Maureen Connolly, there's a story. She was the first American woman to ever win the Calendar Slam, the last one. Serena's trying to win it now, but she was one of the five in the history of the world to do it. Well, after winning Wimbledon, she went over on a practice court and played some practice because she didn't like how she played. So I'd rather win ugly and go fix the ugly. But the point is that that person helped me develop my game or point out weaknesses. So the whole idea here is after the game, he shook hands and looked at each other's eyes or in each other's eyes. And I felt uncannily as if I was becoming a better player and better person. And so I think that is the nature of competition. But I think what happens is coaches don't, not all, but I think coaches don't see that. And a friend of mine said, I agree with him 100%, one of the best ways to fuse all this competition and to learn how to compete properly is to for coaches to get to know each other and be on the same page. I've done this with some teams where I've gone up to the coach and say, "Hey, man, you know, if you have any problems with my guys, let me know," or vice versa. And we're kind of on the same page, and we're, you know, there may be some umpires there, but it's more about the coaches. As a coach goes, the player goes. And so, you know, if we're on the same page with those things and we can actually hold each other accountable and walk away with a great effort and competitive experience, win or lose, we're going to learn more and it's going to be a more positive experience. So I think Joe Irwin has a great point here. When he talks about this competition. And I'm definitely not one of these people. There was a recent story where an NFL player, his son came home with a participation trophy and he gave it back, or a ribbon. And I'm kind of like along those lines. I don't think people should be given things just to participate. It's like, you know, our culture's gotten too participation oriented that way. You know, I think it's great that people participate, but you don't get a trophy just for participating per se. You know, I think the rest of the world is, it's a tough place, and you got to learn how to compete and learn how to work hard for things. And I think kids know, I think parents maybe don't want them to get their feelings hurt, but kids know, they know, man, hey, I didn't work for that. In fact, I've known kids that are like, what's that for? Okay. Yeah. They put it in their drawer. They don't really. They know that blood, sweat, and tears didn't go into it. Anyways, the point being is that true competition is when you bring out the best in somebody and working hard. So I think Joe's made some great points on that. Well, we've covered several things in terms of competition, in terms of a little bit of coaching philosophy with focus, talking about does character build sports, and again going back to that, I think it's more of what the coach does intentionally, and that has to do with competition, being a transformational coach as opposed to transactional coach. And you know, we talked about particularly within the fundamentals and how we are mentally and always giving our best. You know, we covered quite a bit. And if you have any questions, like I said, do give me a call on the or maybe in the next show, and or you can drop me an email at steve@coachsteveclarkphd.com. You can leave some questions there. And I'd like to leave with a thought right here. Is your best inspiring? You know, I talked about rare greatness comes at a steep price. Mediocrity is abundant and cheap. Well, that steep price is inspiring. And so I got a question. Is your average, or is your regular stuff inspiring? You know, if somebody's watching you, what you're doing, when you practice or when you compete, is it inspiring? You know, it doesn't matter if you're a 3-5 or, you know, a great college player. Is what you do out there, is your work ethic, is the way you carry yourself, is it inspiring? So just some words to think over. And next time, I'd like to maybe cover some of the small, I talked about big picture items here, maybe some more of the smaller scope things, but particularly about the mental aspect of the game, controlling momentum and things like that. But tune in to our next shows, and I'll be having other guests, for example, like Alan Fox coming up, talking about his book, Tennis, Winning the Mental Match. We have some other sports psychologists on, as well as former great players coming down the pike, even of the greatness likeness of Roy Emerson. So thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon. And as I say in the song at the end, let her rip.